Recording has started.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. And welcome to the IGO-INGO Access Security of Rights Protection Mechanism call. We're taking place on the 20th of July, 2017. On the call today, we have George Kiriokas, Petter Reinforth, Paul Tattersfield, Phil Corwin, Mason Cole, Osvaldo Nuova, David Maher, Jay Chapman, Nat Cohen, and Pantelet Eligi. I have no listed apologies for today's meeting. From STAC, we have Mary Wong, Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, Dennis Chang, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, thank you, Terry, and welcome all, and sorry for the delay. I called in immediately after getting off a business constituency call that was held just prior and ended about 2 minutes before this, and it was a very long wait today, so apologies for the late start. Petter, I believe it's my turn to chair today that you had chaired last week. Is that correct?
It may be so, although I raised my hand because
yes,
if I can do so, just start with a very quick update on what is actually written in the agreements and the dispute policies when it comes to the court part, so to speak. I've followed the recent discussion, and I also took actually some minutes yesterday to go through some of our old communication, and just wanted to remind everybody about when before we go into details when it comes to different kind of options. That the first step is in all registrars' agreements. These agreements you sign up for, maybe not normally reading it through. You click the box, so to speak, but in all registrars' agreements, there are some kind of sentence that refers to the appropriate domain dispute resolution policy that each new domain holder agrees to be bound by. And that's, as we have said before, this is more as a business agreement. In order for you to actually be able to register a domain name in your name, you have to agree to this registrar's agreement. And all in some way or another refers to dispute resolution policies, for instance, applicable to the domain name you have selected, including the uniform domain name dispute resolution policy. And there is normally a link to that policies. So everybody are referred to the UDRP or the URS, depending on what kind of domain name you register. So that's the first actual agreement you signed up for. And then when you start the dispute resolution procedure, there's always also one of these boxes you have to click on and accept the mutual jurisdiction clause, where the normally is the any challenges that may be made by responding to a decision of the administrative panel to transfer a domain name or to cancel it can be taken to the jurisdiction of the courts at the location of the domain holder's address. That's both parties have, so to speak, signed up at that part to accept it to taking it to a court. And then it's also in the policy as such stated fairly clear that if an administrative panel decides that a domain name registration should be cancelled or transferred, there's this 10 business days waiting period, and that's observed in the location of the principal office after where they are informed by the applicable provider of the administrative panel's decision before implementing that decision. So each party have 10 days, and the losing parties have 10 days, 10 business days, to actually start a procedure in a court. And also, of course, there are already in the rules descriptions of possibility of settlements or other grounds for termination. So if the parties provide the written notice to request to suspend the proceedings because there's a settlement, or if they actually have started court action in the middle of the process, it's up to the panel to decide if the panel wants to proceed with the process or to wait until the agreements decide between the parties, or there is some kind of court decisions. And it's also very clear that once there is a decision, the parties' rights, the complainants have the rights to seeking other relief in a court as provided by law, and it's no specification on which kind of court or which kind of applicable law that can be used. And the respondent's rights, if the complainant prevailed and the domain name has been ordered, cancelled or transferred, the register will wait 10 days before taking action. And within that period, the respondent may begin a lawsuit in an appropriate jurisdiction against the complainant. And what I also quickly emailed earlier today was when it came to the registrar's responsibilities, this 10-day period. I mean, if they got actually an information that the case is taken to a court within the 10 days, there will be no transfer. And then the registrar will not implement the panel's decision and will not take any further action until the registrar has received other satisfactory evidence of a resolution between the parties, or a satisfactory evidence that the lawsuit has been dismissed or withdrawn, or a copy of a court order dismissing the lawsuit. And when we talk about the possibility to actually, if it is dismissed by a court, to take it to the next step for another arbitration, I think here is also what we need to clarify, so that if the court decides not to take the case, then the original decision will be the one. But to avoid the transfer, we need also to put in some administrative process here so that the domain name still holds. So that's just a quick summary of the regulations already there when it comes to the second phase in courts. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for that intervention. Peter, let me briefly comment on that and then get us back to our agenda. But that comports with the email I sent to the group yesterday, which contained the transcript of the oral discussion between you and Paul Keating, who unfortunately is not on today's call, on our call just prior to the Johannesburg meeting, in which the this issue was discussed, and you and Paul had agreed that if in a situation which could occur today, if an IGO prevailed in a UDRP domain registrant appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction, IGO asserted a defense of immunity from the jurisdiction of that court, notwithstanding its agreement to the mutual jurisdiction clause, and there's no telling whether or not a court would accede to that defense. We have no control over the IGO action or the court's decision. That would leave the reinstate the UDRP decision if the case was dismissed per section, and I cited it yesterday. I have it in front of me. That's per section 4K of the UDRP policy, which basically provides for reinstatement of the decision if the lawsuit has been dismissed or withdrawn, or the panel receives a copy of an order from the court dismissing the lawsuit. So the import there is that in the oh, I'm glad to see that Paul just joined us. That's great, because that means Paul can get into discussion of his proposals today. So the import is that if it happened today, the domain registrant in that situation, having lost the judicial forum, would have no remaining appeal under the UDRP rule. So the option two we've been discussing would, in fact, represent an expansion of registrant protections by providing at least an arbitration forum adhering as closely as possible to the substantive and procedural rules of the forum of mutual jurisdiction. So I would propose now, given that we're 20 minutes into the call, that we briefly review item two, which is just the updated text of the co-chair's arbitration elements paper, which, as I explained on the last call, was a paper based on elements that Paul Keating had identified that he would want to see addressed in any arbitration procedure that we might consider in the aftermath to a judicial dismissal of a case based on a an immunity defense. And but rather than spend most of the call discussing the co-chair's paper, I would just think we should note those elements and then get right on to agenda item three and allow I know that both Paul and George Kirikos have other proposals they would like us to consider, and I think it would be better to use our time considering those and then circling back to the proposed option two arbitration when we've thoroughly discussed that. And I see George's hand up. Go ahead, George.
Hi, George Kirikos for the transcript. I noticed that there's some language in this updated document that I don't recognize being part of the older document, but the second paragraph on page one says, none of the elements described below in relation to an arbitration scenario precludes either of the parties from going to a national court at any point in the dispute resolution process. I don't understand how that section was brought in, because the whole point was that the IGO didn't want to go to court and that you're stuck in this arbitration scenario because it was punted from the court. Thanks.
Yeah, good point, George, and I hadn't seen this language, or at least I missed that language. Maybe staff can explain that to it. I see Mary's hand up.
Yes, thank you, Phil, and thanks, George, and maybe we could have put it a different way. That particular sentence and the other, I think, two bullet points under preliminary notes were added by staff after the call last week, and they were meant to capture the pertinent points relating to this discussion paper, as was expressed on the call. And our recollection is that on call, someone, and I can't remember who, so it may have been you, said that as we talk through these arbitration elements, none of this is intended to stop a losing respondent from going to court. It may well be that as we go on with the discussion that we have an either-or option, but as of the status we had last week, I think the idea was that, A, this is something still under discussion, and B, this is not intended to take away the right to go to court unless, of course, there's an agreement to just do binding arbitration. So maybe you should have added that last part in, but that's where
I think, let's just briefly review this paper. We're going to have to come back and do more work on this because at least it's the understanding and intent of this co-chair is that we are in no way contemplating requiring arbitration as an immediate follow-up to a UDRP decision. We're only discussing arbitration as something that results from a dismissal by a court of a judicial appeal brought by a domain registrant if and when the IGO succeeds in asserting an immunity defense. So it needs to be clear that this is only would be contemplated in that very specific and narrow scenario. On the second sentence there about implementation as option, I agree we'd have to think about that, but probably we'd have to suggest some language addition to the language of the UDRP and the URS policy if we wind up endorsing this arbitration option. And as to whether or not this should apply, and I realize a lot of this language is not proposed final language for our report, but just alerting the group to things we need to consider about whether this applies to all IGOs or I guess all entities that claim to be IGOs, although if an IGO claimed judicial immunity, which would be the precursor to this arbitration default, it would have to prove to the court that it was in fact a genuine IGO and the domain registrant could challenge that claim in the court proceeding. But I have to think about it. On one hand, limiting this to IGOs on the GAC list would at least satisfy that concern of the GAC, where they had a concern that some IGOs that were not IGOs would be treated in a special way under anything we recommended. On the other hand, if you had an IGO that wasn't on the GAC list, but that nonetheless convinced the court that it was a genuine IGO and had immunity by restricting this option solely to the GAC list IGOs, you would be depriving the domain registrant in that scenario of a meaningful appeal and after losing its ability to have a court hear its appeal. So I think we need to discuss that further. On the panelist, we did seem to reach some rough consensus last week that any arbitration in this scenario should be heard by a three-member panel chaired by a retired judge from the relevant jurisdiction to assure that the panel was led by someone who had good familiarity with both the substantive law and procedural rules of the jurisdiction. And scrolling down to see if there's any other changes. I don't see any. So, again, unless there's objections, I think it would be better at this point to set this aside and come back to it. But that since we have, and I'll hear you in a second, Petter, since we have Paul Keating with us today and we have George, as he's generally with us, and they have other proposals they'd like to vet with the working group, that we that the co-chairs stand back from this proposal for now and we hear from our working group members with their proposals. Petter, go ahead.
Petter here, just two words. I think it's important that the arbitration phase is closely connected to the immunity defense in the judicial forum, so that we keep the cases as they are today with the court action as the the initial final step, but only if the complainant succeeds in their immunity defense, there should be this second possibility to take it to an arbitration. Thanks.
Right. All right. Thank you for that comment, Peter. And Paul Keating, I'm noting your comment about relevant jurisdiction. How would it be determined? It would be determined by the UDRP rules. For example, if a domain registrant with a right to bring an appeal under the Anti-Cyber-Squatting Protection Act, U.S. law, filed a judicial appeal in the United States and the appeal was dismissed based on an IGO's immunity defense, the arbitration would be determined under the substantive law, under the ACPA, and it would follow as closely as possible the federal rules of procedure. So we'd be trying to mimic a judicial process as much as possible, but with a three-member arbitration panel rendering the decision. That's the intent. But again, unless it's the desire of the working group to get into further discussion of this amended version of option two, I think it might be better to proceed to the proposals from our working group members, particularly Paul Keating, who's not always able to join on our calls. And Paul, yes, it would be the jurisdiction in which the action had been pending.
Thank you, Phil.
Okay. So we have a new document up in front of us, and the first option is the first item on is option three to recommendation four, suggested by Paul Keating on our call of June 15th. So, Paul, I'm going to give you the floor to explain your option here and what you think its merits are, and then we can, as well as responding to any criticisms you might have received on it, on the email list so far, and then we can open up to further discussion by the group. So, Paul, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you. This is Paul Keating for the record. I apologize for any oral problems. I'm unfortunately sitting in a car next to the road. But to clarify, I didn't receive any adverse comments to the suggestion at all that I know of, that I saw anyway. But essentially, it's as summarized. ICANN staff, and thank you very much, summarized it very well, is that it's essentially the NGO's sole legitimate concern here is for a monetary is to protect it from a monetary award as issued by a court of mutual jurisdiction. Any other determination, which is who owns the domain name post UDRP, I don't see as a legitimate concern of the NGO because they, in fact, brought the complaint to begin with. So under my proposal, the only requirement would be for a situation in which the response would be required as part of their response, for example, to waive any claim against the NGO over and above a declaratory relief as to the ownership of the domain name. It's kind of a simplistic approach to a problem which I see as statistically rare, and that is in which NGOs are actually going to complain about sovereign immunity in the first instance. I don't think we have come across one instance in which an NGO has in fact complained on the basis of sovereign immunity in any litigation, any pending litigation in any jurisdiction. So that was my solution. It's kind of a throw the bone out to the NGOs and educate the respondents to understand that it really is of no significant consequence to waive the damage claim. Number one, it's almost impossible to enforce such a damage claim given the current state of the law and the NGO's inability to pay generally anyway. So with that, I'll just turn it over to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul, and I think it's a very interesting proposal. Let me raise two questions, and then I see George has his hand up. The first is I think this might be worth exploring with the IGOs. It might be attractive to them and to the GAC if they were if they could limit their accession to mutual jurisdiction solely to the question of control of the domain name and not be exposed to potential monetary damages. But let me ask one practical question and one policy question. As a practical matter, just as we previously decided that had we adopted the IGO small group proposal, which would have only permitted an arbitration appeal, not an appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction, one of the reasons we rejected that was we questioned the effectiveness of doing that, that there was no way we could prevent a domain registrant from invoking their national law rights where they had them and going to court anyway and putting a hold on the domain through a judicial injunction. So, one, could this be effective? Could we prevent a domain registrant, let's say under the ACPA, from not just contesting a decision, a UDRP decision that their domain should be transferred, but prevent them from seeking monetary damages under that national law? And I guess the related policy question is, would it be proper for us to try to in any way limit a registrant's protections under national law? So those are the questions that arise with me, effectiveness and whether it's a sound policy to try to limit in some way a registrant's rights under a relevant law. So let me call on George now, and then Paul can respond to both of us. I see his hand up. Go ahead, George.
George Quirkos for the transcript again. Just to step back, I think the way this proposal arose was that IGOs were concerned not just with money damages. They were also concerned that the language in the UDRP is likely to be construed as a general waiver of immunity, and so they wanted to make it a more limited waiver of immunity. That general waiver of immunity would apply not just to money damages, but the scenario where, let's say, an employee of WIPO registers WIPOReallySucks.com, and WIPO decides that they want to file a domain dispute. That former employee might sue in court not just based on the outcome of the domain name, but they might counterclaim, you know, employment damages or whatever, stuff that they were unable to do because of the IGO's actual immunity. So WIPO and other IGOs would be concerned that filing the UDRP would open the door to all kinds of other litigations that are unrelated to the domain name. And actually, there's this concept that I was researching called quasi-in-rem, and I'll type that into the chat room, where you're kind of trying to limit the dispute just to the domain name, and so it's kind of like limiting it to the property aspect of the domain name, which is kind of related to the in-rem lawsuits that I've been talking about, I and others have been talking about, as other ways to affect the outcome of the domain name without actually suing the IGO in court. So to go back to one of Paul's points, though, the limited form of the waiver by the IGO in the in a new proposed UDRP, that would be presumably language only agreed to by the IGO, switching from the general waiver to more limited waiver. It's not something that the domain name owner would have to necessarily agree with. So this can actually still go to court, and folks can still duke it out whether there's an immunity or not on that issue. But all we would be saying is that going into the UDRP, the IGO only agreed to this limited waiver, and it's still up for a court to decide, you know, what that waiver means. And the IGO could still argue immunity, it may or may not have, depending on, you know, the type of IGO, whether it has functional immunity or absolute immunity, et cetera. So it goes to what the kind of express waiver is. And this point is, I assume that if we did option three, which could be tagged on to either of the other options. It's not just an either or, it's kind of like a parallel kind of option to the other options. That we solidify the language, making it clear that the mutual jurisdiction is in fact an express waiver of immunity, that the IGO, would have a much harder time trying to dislodge that immunity in other cases. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, George. And I tend to be in agreement with what you just said. I think this suggestion has, I've expressed some questions about it, but it has some merits. And frankly, besides being something that would ameliorate the GAC and the IGOs to some extent, and if it's contained in a final report, as you just observed, it actually might negate further the possibility of a court totally dismissing the case if the waiver, if the acceptance of mutual jurisdiction by the IGO was limited to the question of the control of the domain name, and thereby provide a greater likelihood that the registrant would have a day in a real court and not before an arbitration forum, as option two contemplates. Mary, you had your hand up. I was going to call on you next before Paul. Did you have something you want to interject at some point before Paul speaks?
Hi, Phil. Thanks for noticing. This is Mary from staff. I think you and George have covered a number of the, I guess, supplemental questions that we would need to examine if this goes any further. So the other remaining point I'll make is, as George says, this does not need to be an either option. It could be combined with, say, an arbitral option or something else. And so to that extent, the question as to when the waiver has to take place, that could be tied into any additional requirement of having to first agree to arbitration. So it need not be at the time when you register domain or when you file the complaint, although filing the complaint may be the logical place to put it. In other words, there's probably a way to do this where the waiver is clear, but this doesn't really resolve the other issues around it, which is the immunity itself still has to be argued. Thanks, Phil.
Right. Okay. Thanks for those points, Mary. Mr. Keating, please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Paul Keating, for the record, put my hand down here. In listening to these comments, they're legitimate in terms of the way I see it is how do we get the complainant, the IGO, to actually waive something in a concrete fashion? So I would actually take the concept that I proposed and I'd turn it on its head. So I wouldn't make the respondent be waiving anything. I would make the complainant qualify the waiver. So in other words, if we're acting on the assumption that the IGOs are concerned about damage claims as opposed to the possession of the domain name itself, then if we could insert, Mary, this addresses your concern, we could insert in the jurisdictional, the certification and the rules in, 3B, Roman numeral 12, I think, where the complainant certifies to the mutual jurisdiction. You could state in there that, if the complainant is an IGO, then for the purposes of an acknowledged IGO, okay, then the IGO agrees not to assert sovereign immunity to any claim except, it waives its right to assert sovereign immunity as to claims pertaining only to the possession and ownership of the domain name, but it may reserve any sovereign immunity claims that it has as to non-possession remedies, in other words, damages. Right? Then you've got the complainant coming in and clarifying that the extent of its claim of sovereign immunity at the get-go when the UDRP is filed. The respondent, George, wouldn't have to do anything. So the respondent doesn't have to agree. The respondent can go to court afterwards. The IGO then asserts sovereign immunity. The respondent stands up and says, number one, the sovereign immunity claim is bunk because there's been a waiver. And if that doesn't, or the IGO is not really an IGO, And if the respondent loses, then on those arguments, the respondent is arguing alternatively that, yes, Your Honor, but the case doesn't get dismissed. It's just the damage claims are not recoverable, and I can go seek other remedies if I have them. But you have to respond to the issue of possession and ownership of the domain name post-UDRP under the normal rules of this litigation in this jurisdiction. So that's kind of how I would approach it, given these very legitimate concerns and questions that have been raised during the call. Now, and I think that structurally that's very possible to do with a very minor modification to the UDRP rules, not the policy itself, in which case this modification does not need to be embedded within the RAA, the accreditation agreement with the registrars, or the registration agreement, since both of those link back to the UDRP in its present form, right, as it may be a changed over time. So I think it's a simplistic version where you just come in and we're addressing one small issue that reserves as much benefit for the respondent as possible, but protects any legitimate, you know, concerns of the IGO that they may be held accountable to, you know, a large damage claim. Okay. I do want to make it clear to the group that I firmly believe that there's a waiver here, and I firmly believe in our original position that we took. I understand politically that that's a hard swallow for the powers that be, and I guess I'm kind of willing to offer this as an alternative, but this is as far as I'm willing to go. I really do not. I would be tremendously opposed to creating a parallel arbitration system of any sort or nature, right? The last point I make is that, or I make two points if I can. One is a response to George. The example with the WIPO employee probably is not a great one because the WIPO employee has probably signed an employment agreement which obligates them to arbitrate, right? So I don't think that those types of claims are out there. The last point I'll make is a point that I raised in a subsequent email where I kind of had this nirvana moment about what litigators would really do here. Personally, as a litigator, I wouldn't be so concerned if an NGO or an IGO, rather, successfully asserted a claim of sovereign immunity and I was doing a post-UDRP action, because in my actions, the registrar is always a party to the action. The reason for that is because any court order has to be enforceable. And I want to make sure that the registrar is legally obligated to enforce the court order that I get, and so I make them a party to the action. I stipulate with them that I'm not seeking any damages from them, and they don't need to respond. They just need to agree that they'll abide by the court order. And I think if I have that, then if an IGO does escape on sovereign immunity grounds, I can still proceed against the domain name in an in rem action to seek possession, and I have the registrar there as a party to actually get enforcement. So in my life, none of this will impact me as a practitioner. But I think that it's a good, bone that we can throw the IGO's way and not complicate everybody's lives to any significant extent. And I'll take my hand down and go on mute. Thank you.
Okay. Very useful further explanation, Paul. Does any other member of the working group have any questions about this option 3 proposal from Paul or any additional points they'd like to make in regard to it? And Mary, I see your hand up again.
Yes, it was, Phil. And if I may, I'd just like to ask Paul a follow-up question, because I'm not an expert in any of these fields. And it's in relation to the very specific point that George made, and Paul, you followed up on, about pursuing an in rem, or as George says, I in rem action. It seems to me that that's something that is possible under U.S. law. I think we've talked a little bit about the Anti-Cyber Spotting Prevention Act. I don't know the extent to which that would be a realistic option in other jurisdictions. So maybe we don't have the answers before us today. If Paul has some insight, that'll be helpful. If not, is this something that we need to think a little bit further on? Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Phil, can I respond to Mary?
Yeah, please.
Great comment.
Well, and after you respond, I have one further question for clarification for you.
This is Paul. This is Paul Keating for the record. Mary, it's a great point. In the U.S., under the ACPA, in order to assert in rem jurisdiction under that act, you must allege and establish that that the court has no personal jurisdiction over the defendant. There are other things that have to occur as well. You have to bring that action in a jurisdiction in the United States in which the registry, or the domain name resides. Okay, but the lack of personal jurisdiction is a secondary requirement. If you can't establish, if the court does have jurisdiction over the IGO, then you technically could not utilize an in rem action in the U.S. under the ACPA. The same is true as if you're bringing the in rem action in a jurisdiction in the United States in which neither the registry nor the registrar nor the domain name existed. That's already been decided in the Second Circuit in a case brought by Mattel. So that's pretty well established. The other question you have, which is to what extent does in rem jurisdiction exist in non-U.S. jurisdictions? I frankly don't have the answer for you on that. I do know, however, that in very few jurisdictions that I've encountered, is there actually a post-UDRP cause of action for a respondent. In most jurisdictions, that includes England, that includes Australia. I've tried three times and not gotten it past. We've chickened out and settled all cases before the final decision about it, but there are very strong arguments that the court had no jurisdiction because there was no underlying legal claim. In jurisdictions which are civil law in nature, there are frequently not civil statutes that would embody a post-UDRP claim. We're attempting one right now in Luxembourg, and I'll let you know whether or not that's going to prevail or not. But I think it's something that should be looked into. But I do think that in any jurisdiction, I'd probably be able to convince a judge to continue the action and continue the claim, even though the IGO was no longer a party as a result of sovereign immunity claims. I'd either add the ADR provider as a defendant or the registrar as a provider. I'd add enough parties to the action that the court would probably, I'd feel comfortable that the court would weigh in and say, okay, fine, we'll continue this discussion. Because it really doesn't have anything to do with the IGO. Right? The IGO is not really a necessary party from a factual standpoint. Their trademark exists or doesn't exist. And I'll
okay. Hey, two quick questions I have, Paul, and then we'll get back to the other folks who want to speak. Other than the U.S. with the ACPA, you seem to have broad experience in this. How many other nations have some national law in which a domain registrant could proceed with an appeal from a UDRP decision? You seem to be saying it's extremely limited.
I don't know. Currently, as I sit here, I don't know of any of them that have a statute like the ACPA that's been recognized as allowing that claim. I've not encountered any. There are very few jurisdictions that have the concept of declaratory relief, which is essentially what the ACPA claim is.
Okay. So basically you're saying unless the domain registrant is a U.S. citizen or is a non-U.S. party which has used a U.S. registrar, you don't know of any other law that a judicial appeal could
be. Well, that's not the basis of jurisdiction under the ACPA. I mean, the ACPA is, as long as you have any basis of asserting jurisdiction under the ACPA, and you have the best part about it would be to have a domain name that's subject to U.S. law by way of registry or registrar or registrant,
right.
Then you can get in under the ACPA.
Right.
And if the complainant slash defendant does not have a U.S. trademark, they're going to lose automatically anyway.
Okay. So let me ask you this. And again, we've been discussing. One, the circumstances where a domain registrant can bring an appeal are extremely limited, primarily to if there's U.S. jurisdiction. Through some means, so far.
Well, I know.
You know.
Can I jump in one second,
yes.
Phil? When I said the UK doesn't recognize it, the the UK hasn't addressed this specific issue relative to the UDRP. In the Emirates case, they addressed it in connection with a .co.uk domain name, and they found that that there was no post DRS avenue for a litigant to bring a claim in the UK based upon an assertion that the DRS was incorrect.
Okay.
the nominate process.
All right. Here's my quick follow-up question. In a scenario where a domain registrant, for whatever reason, was able to bring an appeal from an adverse UDRP decision under the ACPA, if the judge in that case, notwithstanding the mutual jurisdiction clause of the UDRP, was convinced by an IGO that it was a real IGO and notwithstanding that agreement had immunity and dismissed the case, would we need something like the Option 2 arbitration clause to provide some appeal to that registrant, or do they have other in rem or other legal recourse where they could still protect the domain name if the ACPA suit was dismissed?
If the ACPA suit was dismissed and that was the mutual jurisdiction, I wouldn't see an avenue of remedy for the respondent.
Okay.
The plaintiff. I wouldn't see it because there would be no claim under the existing language of the UDRP. There would be a dismissal of the action, which caused the delay of the enforcement of the UDRP decision. Therefore, the UDRP decision would basically be carried out, right? Because that's I don't remember what paragraph of the policy it is. I think it's paragraph 3.
No, it's 4K. We just went over it before you got.
Well, 4K allows for the mutual jurisdiction within the 10 days, but then there's another section up above that says the registrar will transfer the domain name in the following events, and the list 3. I think that's in paragraph 3, but I'm not sure. And so, in my viewpoint, if the underlying action was dismissed, as opposed to a party in the action being dismissed, if the underlying action was dismissed, I think the UDRP decision would then be carried out. And that's why I was in favor, and I proposed originally the concept that in the event that the dismissal was the result of the NGO's assertion of sovereign immunity, then the UDRP decision became a nullity.
Okay.
And that was the fair give and take out of that scenario for me.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. George, go ahead.
Sure.
George Kirikos for the transcript. Yeah, just to go back to the ACPA, usually the ACPA in rem is brought by the trademark owner and not necessarily the domain name owner. The trademark owner is trying to assert their ownership of the domain name. However, the fact that you can rely upon the ACPA in rem provisions doesn't mean that you can't apply general, common law reasoning for in rem lawsuits, as long as the property is located within the court's reach. So if it's at the location of the registrar or the location of the registry. So for example, let's say an IGO goes after a domain name owned by an Australian domain name owner registered at an Australian registrar, kind of a worst case scenario given the judicial history of Australian challenges to the UDRP. All the IGO has agreed to the mutual jurisdiction of the Australian courts, because those are the only options. Nothing would preclude the domain name owner from filing a court case in Virginia, the location, if it's a .com, the location of the VeriSign registry, in order to assert a cause of action in rem against the domain name itself, because that's where the domain name is located, and that's where a court would have in rem jurisdiction over that property. So I think there's still avenues available that aren't all accounted for. And not to reopen the debate before, but while the UDRP itself delineates one mechanism of challenging the UDRP, that isn't the only option. One could use all other means to challenge that decision without involving the IGO itself as the counterparty. And so as long as those court cases are alive, the registrar who holds that domain name is going to keep that domain name under registrar lock. And while any action against the IGO might have been dismissed, that doesn't mean that the matter is fully resolved until all pending litigation is also exhausted. Thank you.
I had a comment, George.
Yes, thanks, George. Petter, next.
Thanks, Petter here. And I actually have an additional question to Paul, so it's good to see that he's just asked me in line. It's what you said, if I understand you correctly. When you have a court action, you also involve the registrar. But isn't it so that in the majority of the registrar's agreement, they have a general clause that they say that they will act, or sometimes they will only act with the domain name that they are responsible for, based on a court decision. So that means that they don't have to be a part of the. They don't have to be sued. You can only just show the court decision, and they will act according to their agreement, based on that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Petter. And Paul, back to you.
Okay.
Paul Keating. Discussion
here. Paul Keating for the record. So, Petter, I'm going to answer yours first because it's a faster one, and then George, I get to yours. Yes, you don't have to name the registrar. You could rely on their contractual promise to abide by the court order, but I'd prefer not to because in that case, I've got a judgment, and now I'm trying to enforce it against the party over whom the issuing court had no jurisdiction. So now I have to then file a lawsuit in Australia, if it's Fabulous, for example, and I have to sue Fabulous to seek enforcement of a judgment that they contractually agreed to defend, to abide by, and that they have all the defenses under their contract for not having done so, including the fact that they were not parties to the action. So I prefer not to go that path. I understand from a European standpoint, we're used to relying on statutes, but in this case, there is no underlying law to the domain space. This is all based upon contract. Okay, the only impact that the law has here is in the remedy side, right? And that's only in some instances. But the rest of this whole environment that we're involved in is all contractually based. So that's the first thing. The second thing, so now, George, in terms of in rem, yes, I can proceed in any jurisdiction I can find that the court has jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over the litigants. And to the extent that I cannot establish personal jurisdiction over the litigants, then that litigant is going to be dismissed. If that dismissed litigant is considered to be a material party to the litigation, the court may well dismiss the entire action. Now, the only thing that prevents me from going, let me give you an example. If I have a domain name, a .com domain name that's registered with Fabulous, and the complainant, who happens to be an IGO, certifies to mutual jurisdiction at the principal address of Fabulous, which is in Queensland, Australia, I could actually forego the entire process and file an ACPA in rem action and any other kind of action in the United States. But in doing so, I'm foregoing the 10-day automatic injunction that applies, the 10 business day injunction. So that if that 10 days lapses and I don't provide Fabulous with a copy of a complaint that was filed in the mutual jurisdiction, Fabulous can transfer that domain name tomorrow. In which case, now I'm fighting to get back property that's in the possession of somebody else and who may subsequently transfer it. My only other remedy would be to run in really, really fast into a different court that say I wanted to commence an action in Virginia as an in rem action as opposed to the mutual jurisdiction in Florida, in Australia. I'd have to get an injunction, a TRO from that court directed towards Fabulous to prevent them from transferring the domain name, notwithstanding the fact that I didn't file in a mutual jurisdiction. So that's the risk that you run in there in your scenario. Does that answer that question?
George Kricos here. Just reading the text of the law, it could be a jurisdiction of competent jurisdiction. It doesn't necessarily have to be the mutual jurisdiction where one sues.
Agreed, George. But if I sue in a court of competent jurisdiction and I don't sue in the mutual jurisdiction, I do not benefit from that automatic 10 business day stay. Okay? So in other words, once the 10 business days is gone, if I don't separately present the registrar with a TRO or other injunctive order, that domain name is gone. On day 11, the registrar is going to transfer that domain name according to the UDRP decision. So it imposes, if I don't want to use the mutual jurisdiction, I want to use some other competent jurisdiction, that's fine. But that's almost an impossible burden to sustain as a respondent, to get a lawyer, to prepare the complaint, to get an ex parte hearing before a judge, to issue a TRO, and then serve it on the registrar in a foreign jurisdiction, all within that 10-day period would be very, very difficult to respond and very expensive.
Hey. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for that, Paul. I think we're all learning a lot more than we ever knew, those of us who don't litigate, about the practicalities and the details and the challenges of effectively litigating these domain cases in very complicated scenarios. So, George, did you have further comment on this proposal? If not, I want to raise a procedural issue.
I was just going to make a quick point that, you know, as a practical matter, when there's a lawsuit filed in competent jurisdiction, the registrar is going to still hold the domain name and maintain the status quo regardless of whether it's in, whether there's a UDRP panel decision. You know, it could be a completely separate lawsuit, but they're just going to freeze the status quo and hold it under litigation lock. I actually talked to my role in registrar about that today just to double check. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Let me note now that we are 1 hour and 5 minutes in Virgo, at least past its scheduled starting time, not counting the delay we had because the operator problem stayed. We've got 25 minutes left. We've covered the first proposal on this paper, which is Paul's. The second one is George's, and then the third one is another one of Paul's. Now, I'm noting, I want to assure everyone, we're going to have a complete discussion of both of these remaining options, but I'm noting as a practical matter that Paul sometimes has difficulty joining these calls based on his other attorney responsibilities. While George is, I can't recall a call where you weren't on with us, George. So I'd like to ask Paul whether he contemplates, if we don't have we may only have time to discuss one more of these proposals in the remaining 25 minutes. Paul, do you contemplate being able to join us next Thursday? And if you're not, I would then ask George whether he would be chagrined if we let Paul present his other proposal while giving George full assurance that at the next call, if we don't get to it today, he'd have as much time as he needs to present his proposal, which is here as option 4 to recommendation 4. So let me ask Paul, do you think he'll be on the call next week, or is that dicey?
No, I will be on the call. I've cleared the schedule for Thursday. That's not a problem for me. So I would like to hear George's. But I also two quick points. One is I did preview the third one as part of the comments that I made in the second one, the first option. But more to the point is I'd like an opportunity to further draft out option 1 in light of some of the comments that I heard today, which is how to make it an effective waiver on the complainant side. So would like is if I could say today and tomorrow, and then provided I send it out on Monday, maybe we could tee that up either Thursday coming or following with respect to revising my option one to make it a waiver, a conditional waiver on behalf of the IGOs.
So far as this co-chair is concerned, that would be welcome. We'd welcome your further refinement of the proposal based on today's discussion, and we can return to discussing it because it seems to have some, you know, possible merits for a number of reasons. So that would be great if you can do that, and we'll assure you of full opportunity to vet that revised version in a future call.
Okay, excellent. And then, so then let's
see, my co-chair Petter just checked off on that as well.
Okay, excellent. Then George, I leave the floor to you.
George, go ahead and proceed, and please present your item two on our this document, which is option four to recommendation four, and lay it out and why you think it has merit, and address any concerns you've heard about it so far, and then we'll open it up to full discussion.
Okay, just quickly. George Kriegel, for the transcript. Just quickly to go back to that option number five for procedural aspect. Paul had raised it on the mailing list last week, and I actually already countered it with regards to it missing the supplemental rules, which cover the language that he thought that wasn't there. So I don't know whether he still wants to put forth that proposal at all. It seems to be that it's not going to survive much scrutiny. I don't know if he saw the email I already sent to the list, but it kind of poked a serious hole in that proposal.
Okay, well, let me ask Paul. Your alternative proposal three on this document, which you said in some way related to the one we just discussed, is that something you want to have discussed? I think you just indicated you did want to bring it up on a future call. Is that correct?
Well, this is Paul Keating. Are we talking about? So, George, are you? I'm confused. Are you saying that your option two is no longer an option?
George Kriegel here. No. It was that second option that regarding a clean appraisal, where you thought that we could do nothing because the complainant made a certain certification, but the respondent didn't. I actually sent an email to the list last Friday, which said that the respondent actually does make the identical certification. They don't do it under the URP rules itself. They do it under the arbitration provider's supplemental rules. So I don't know whether you still want to put forth that proposal, but the underlying premise of it was actually incorrect.
I'm sorry. I must have missed that one. So I'll go back and look through that again, George.
Okay. Definitely in the supplemental rules. So if that disposes of that discussion, we could have that discussion now. But I can go with option four either today or next week. I'll be on all the calls.
I'd like you to proceed with yours because I'm not ready to address the question you just raised. I'm not ready to address it. So please go forward with your alternative proposal.
Just let the co-chair intervene. Paul, you're going to go ahead and review George's email response on your other proposal, and it's your option whether you want to present it on a future call. You're not foreclosed. And, George, the floor is yours to present option four to recommendation number four, which is item two on the document before us.
Okay. George Kriegel again. The full option four is on the mailing list, and I sent a link to it on the in the Adobe chat room. There's a kind of an edited version on the pod that was missing some of the details. But basically, the idea is that back when I proposed it, there seems to be division within the group, and we might split 50-50 between options one and two and not achieve an actual 100% consensus in either scenario. So my thought was, is there a way to bridge the gap so that we can actually achieve a full consensus where 100% of the working group can back one single option? And so I came up with a hybrid solution, which says you grandfather existing domain names going by creation date, and those would go under option number one. So it doesn't take away the legal rights to access to the courts for domain name registrations. It doesn't change the rules in the middle of the game. And then for all domain names after the implementation of the policy, say January 1, 2018, or whatever the appropriate date is, then we could go with an option number two. However, combined with that is the provision that it's a stronger option two than had been presented to that date, so it had the open court principle. And actually, we call it the open court principle in Canada, but in the United States, you might know it as the open justice. So if you go to the Wikipedia article on open justice, it basically describes the exact same thing for court documents are available for the public to review, and that transparency affords great protection against bad things happening in the courts. Anyway, stronger version of option number two would only apply to the newly created domain names. Furthermore, there'd be a tracking system for all of those cases that went through option two, so that there'd be a mandatory review after either a certain number of cases had happened or after a lapsed amount of time, so that we go back and see, you know, what actually happened under the option number two. Because all too often, I can implement a policy that has unintended consequences, and this system would have a built-in review that, you know, there's no barrage of new cases trying to take advantage of a procedure that wasn't fully implemented properly, or that had loopholes or whatever, or the arbitration providers didn't, you know, provide an equivalent level of due process than, you know, was desired to mimic, you know, the courts. And so that mandatory review would be a condition of the implementation of option two for those new domains. And there'd be a safeguard, which isn't actually in the pod, but it's actually in the email sent. I hadn't numbered it, but I sent it to the mailing list. And, you know, should that review not happen in a timely manner, then there's, you know, a safeguard that there's a self-termination clause, and, you know, the default would be that it goes back to option one, and all domains would proceed until, you know, there's a future review by ICANN that, you know, ensured that the system was operating as intended. I see Mary has a question. George, can you repeat the rationale for limiting this option to new registrations? Yeah, sure. It's just a matter of grandfathering existing registrants, because we want to not experiment with their rights and play with you know, what their expectations are in terms of their registrations when they acquire their domains. And so it's, you know, not changing the game midstream. It's, you know, guaranteeing their access to the courts, which I think even the UDRP from 1999 intended them to have. And we have the precedents, which identified on the mailing list, of the IGO reserve names policy, which just completed its comment period, where reserve names that exist on a list don't apply to all existing domain name registrations. They were all grandfathered. And I sent a link to the mailing list to that public comment period. That's the general scope of it, and, you know, we could refine it, but the idea is you try to have the best of both worlds and not have everybody completely happy, not have everybody completely sad, but hopefully reach a consensus of 100%, or at least a strong majority of the group, whereas, you know, without this kind of a middle proposal, you know, we risk having a 50-50 split, or reaching no consensus, or having, you know, a minority report by people who are saddened by whatever decision is actually recommended. And another justification for grandfathering is that the whole reason we're having this PDP is that IGO names were protected under a reserve list that was created due to the new GDLD process. And so we're only having this debate because IGOs have repeatedly lost in the past in prior debates of this nature, and thought that, well, you know, with the deluge of new GTLDs, we need this protection. So this whole thing was premised on new GTLDs, not existing domains. My proposal actually would apply to legacy TLDs too. It's just a matter of whether it's the domain name being before a certain creation date or after a creation date, regardless of TLD. Did anyone have any questions, concerns? I see Mary has her hand up.
Yeah, go ahead, Mary. I've got some questions.
May I follow up, Joe?
But you go ahead first.
Thank you, and thanks, George, for the explanation. So none of this is any comment from staff on the options and the proposals. You know, the substantive questions there have to be reviewed by the work group. From our side on the staff side, we're just trying to work out how this might work. And since it's the first time we're talking about it, I apologize in advance for any sort of half-coherent thoughts that are going to come out of my mouth any minute. Obviously, the question that I asked you, you've already answered in terms of making a distinction between new registrations and the ones that came before. I think what we're looking at in our minds is because the UDRP is consensus policy, it applies to all GTLDs, you know, whether legacy or new or the ones to come. It's a little different from the URS because the URS, as we all know, only applies to the current round of new Gs and presumably the ones to come unless that's changed, not the ones before. So I think in my mind, we're trying to figure out how this would sit. And even for the grandfathering, for the IGO implementation that you highlighted, there was a process, as if I recall correctly, where in the beginning, you know, those registrations would not be affected for the reasons that you've noted. But should they be dropped or deleted, pending delete at some point, then there is a process that sort of brings them into the fold. So I offer that as one possible thought further down the line, as in if we go into this, we might want to consider some kind of, I don't even know what the right word for it, not a remedial process, but equalizing process, if you like. And the last comment I'll make, again, for folks to think about and to consider, is that in between the adoption of a consensus policy, and our PDP would hopefully result in consensus policies, even if it's to do nothing and to do very minimal things, there is an implementation phase, and then the new policy is announced. Primarily, this is going to go out to registries and registrars, and optimally, it's usually with at least a six-month lag. So to the extent that we need to ensure that folks with the existing registrations understand that something's going to change, there is the possibility and some time to do that in. Thanks, Phil. Thanks, George.
George Kourikos, can I quickly respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead, George, and then I've got a couple of questions to kind of probe this a bit. But
just
go ahead.
Tackle the last point first. Existing registrants, you know, aren't going to necessarily see a change. It's just going to be, you know, option number one, which is the nullification option. If it went to dispute, it's more if going to affect newly created domain names, not already existing domain names. And further to the point about what happens under deletions, I agree that it could follow the existing proposed procedure for that IGO reserve list, that if a domain name is deleted, it then becomes freshly created at some later date that's after the implementation of this new proposed policy. So let's say a domain name gets deleted on January 1st, 2020, then it would go through the option two route under the scenarios that we've been talking about, instead of the option number one route for a domain name registered in 1994 or 1996 or whatever. So that would be very consistent with, and that's actually already consistent with what I've proposed because it goes by creation date. So that handles the situation of transfers, transfers unaffected, either transfer of ownership as well as isn't affected. It's only deletions because that would cause a new creation date. Thanks.
Okay. This is Phil. I'll be brief because we're down to the last 8 minutes here. Mary, let me just ask you this. I agree. UDRP is consensus policy. It applies to both new TLDs and legacy TLDs. The URS for now is a implementation detail for the new TLD program, and the question of whether it should be comp consensus policy is currently before another working group, the one reviewing all RPMs and all GTLDs, and we don't know yet what they're going to recommend on that. But just focusing on the UDRP, I suppose there would be a way to differentiate based on registration date in the UDRP between treatment based on registration date. But would you agree that that would require some substantial amendment of the policy itself to do so? That's what I'm thinking.
George Karikos again.
I was asking, can we have Mary answer and then you can speak, George? It's a question to Mary. And then you can speak. Mary?
Thank
I'm
you,
not hearing you, Mary.
I don't know that I'm in a position to... Can you hear me now?
Yes, hear you now.
Okay, great. Sorry, I was moving around a little. I don't know that I can provide a complete clear answer, Phil. It strikes me that when we were first talking about these options, that there would need to be some kind of at least an addition to the existing policies, in this case the UDRP. So there would be some form of amendment in the form of an additional provision. And I think that's what caused me to ask the question, as in when we do that, you know, we would then have to be very clear in the language that this only applies to registrations, you know, made after a certain date. It's not impossible. It seems a little, I think, awkward at this stage, but it's something that I think we should flag either on the policy phase before the implementation phase, because I just don't know what sorts of feasibility or communication or understanding issues it might create for registries and registrars, for example.
Okay. Okay, thanks for that answer. George, go ahead on that point, and then I had one or two additional questions.
Yeah, George Karikos, this isn't conceptually very hard. It's not affecting, you know, WIPO or NAF or any of the UDRP providers at all. It's only affecting the registrars, what they're supposed to do when presented with this you know, scenario dismissal by the court. So it's a very narrowly defined set of instructions, you know, what to do in that scenario. You know, the way we're going with option number one or number two, we're already going to be advising them what to do. All we're doing is saying creation date before XY before a certain date, do this. Creation date after a certain date, do that. So it's conceptually a trivial implementation.
Well, yeah, George, I wasn't saying it was as proposed. It is fairly black and white. I was just saying to affect it, if we were to agree as a working group to go this way, what would be required to affect it? And I'm thinking we probably have to add some new language to the UDRP itself to do this. That's all I was probing with on that point.
We have to add language to the UDRP regardless of whether we go option number one, two, three, or four. Like, all these are requiring slight amendments somewhere. To implement, I think there's like an option number five or six or number six. Well, option number five, pocketing, is kind of do absolutely nothing, which I guess is the only one that actually requires no modification to the UDRP itself. But every other option is making minor adjustments, not to the legal standard of how a UDRP is decided by the panel, but how the registrar responds to various scenarios. Thanks.
Okay. George, let me ask you, why did you go with creation date? Let me ask a question that would probably arise immediately. Why should we grandfather, and I'm not sure grandfathering is the right term because I believe this contemplates being done in concert with something else, but I'll get back to that in a second. Why would we not subject domains transferred after the effective date, whatever it turns out to be? In other words, if there's a change in registrant, what would be the justification for continuing with the what you describe as grandfathering?
It's the George Karikos again. It's the exact same rationale that applies to the grandfathering of all, you know, two-letter.coms, one-letter.coms, which are actually registry reserved and can't be re-registered if they were actually deleted. So it's those domains can all be transferred to. Same for the IGO reserve names list. The idea is that this is a contract, and anybody should be allowed to assign that contract to somebody else. That's all.
Okay. So just so I understand it, when you say grandfathering, I believe you contemplate that doing this, that is implementing option two, which would be the post-dismissal. This would apply, option two would apply in cases where a judicial appeal was dismissed for a newly registered domain that was dismissed based on a successful assertion of judicial immunity by an IGO, but that this will be combined with option one in our original report, which was the recommendation that where a IGO succeeds in successfully asserting immunity, that the original UDRP should be vitiated rather than enforced, which, as we've discussed, would probably be the result under the current policy. Is that correct?
George Kirkus here. Yeah. I think Mary didn't like the word vitiate, and so the word nullify might be better. But, yeah, the existing domains that are already created would be nullified under that scenario instead of going to the arbitration under option number two.
Okay. And I'll stop. I see Petter's hand up. The last thing I want to say on that, not to beat a dead horse, but I have expressed my personal opinion based on my interactions with the GNSO Council, in which I serve for the business constituency, and with members of the board, that our original option one would not make it through the remainder of the process and become ICANN policy, and that would in effect free up, if that resulted in the rejection of our entire report, would free up the IGOs to work with the GAC to pursue their original desire, which is an IGO-specific CRP in which registrants have no judicial rights, which I don't think any member of this group would want to see implemented. With that, I'm going to Paul Keating, I see your hand up, and then Petter, and we're at 1:30. I'm going to allow those two final comments, and then we'll adjourn. And but I do want to say I think we've had a really productive and constructive discussion today, and we'll continue it next week. But with final comments now from Paul Keating, and then my co-chair, Petter.
Thank you. This is Paul Keating for the record. George, I had a question which was centered around the concept of the transfer versus expiration, and specifically given the current environment in which expired domain names go through this pending delete period, which they're technically expired. They can be recovered. There's a redemption period, then there's pending delete. And then somewhere in there, there's this kind of gray area where the domains are put out to auction or they're captured by the registrar in a sister entity or some such. Would those domain names be, I guess at what point would you consider a domain name to have been expired for the purposes of the grandfathering provision to lapse, given what happens in reality in the system?
Yeah, George Kirkus here. It would go, it would need to be strictly deleted. So any name that's, going through like Snap Names or NameJet for an auction in that period, it would still be, would not change the creation date. So it would still be just like any twoletter.com that's grandfathered or any other IGO reserve name that's grandfathered. It would not go under the option number two. And I think Petter had a question.
Yes, Petter, you get the last word today. Go ahead.
Petter. First, I echo Philip. It's been a very good meeting with a lot of interesting points. I just wanted to say that personally, even if I have some. Difficulties with alternative two. I think there are two points there that I presume that we can agree upon, and that is to for ICANN to collect information about all the IGO disputes and to have it as official as possible, at least with the parties involved and the specific domain names, and also to something that we could actually add into our final suggestion and comments, to have within 5 years, or as you stated, after 10 disputes, it may be the same time limit there in practice, to actually have already new set up a specific timeline where we will, or another working group will look at this new system to see how it worked. Thanks.
Can I, George Rikos, can I quickly comment on that?
Go ahead, George. Brief.
I just wanted to thank you for liking that suggestion, because it was a sincere effort to try to reach across the aisle so that we get the best policy outcome that we can all accept. So if that helps to try to achieve that full consensus that people that are backing option two can move behind, then that's a step forward, because otherwise we'd be a divided group that's not going to reach any consensus. And just make one other quick point about whether it goes through the board or the GAC. I posted a link about the .Amazon decision, and the GAC can play its politics. They're not necessarily the alpha and the omega as to what happens at ICANN. It's a grassroots organization, bottom up, and we're the bottom, and we're the ones that are doing the hard work. And for them to want to engage in machinations that undermine our work is not something that we need to engage in ourselves. It's our job to do the hard work. Thank you.
Yeah, and two quick comments, George. One, in regard to the GAC, I did actually, I'm working with counsel right now on a response to the GAC communique advice on IGOs contained in the Johannesburg communique, and I noted to fellow council members today the Amazon decision, which specifically found that the GAC position in that situation was not based on sound law or policy concerns, and I think there's some similarities here, but I'm more concerned about council rejection and having 3 years of our work not go forward through council. I'm glad that Petter brought up the support for the data gathering. I meant to say that. I think that provision of your proposal has great merit, because we're finding in the RPM review working group that we're having considerable difficulty reaching decisions on some of the issues before us, because ICANN has not done a very good job of requiring data to be gathered on policies and their implementation, and we need to do a much better job of actually tracking discrete issues so we can see how the results of our policy play out in the years after they're adopted and implemented. So we're going to be meeting again 1 week from today, same time, same channel. We'll continue any discussion of we'll discuss Paul Keating's amended version of his limited waiver. We can continue any discussion of George's proposal. We'll leave it to Paul to whether he wants to present his third proposal. Then we'll get back to the updated chair's discussion paper on option two arbitration elements, and we'll continue to march toward hopefully working toward a final report early this fall that can be delivered before the ICANN meeting in Abu Dhabi at the end of October, at least be issued before then. And I want to note for the group, I will be on next week's call. The following 2 weeks I'll be on vacation. I'll be up in Maine. I may or may not be able to join the call depending on my plans for those Thursdays, but if I am on the call, I may only be on the chat room, because the cell phone service where I'm staying is close to non-existent, and there's no landline in the cabin that I'm staying in. So just want to put everybody on notice on that, and thanks again to great staff work, and thanks for hanging in on this call, and we'll talk to you all next week. Goodbye.
See you then. Bye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Darren, the operator, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.